Good evening and welcome to Corporations and Democracy for March 21st, 2024. This is the program that examines how corporations dominate our democracy and what citizens are doing to replace corporate dominance with true democracy. I'm Steve Scalmanini with co-host Annie Esposito. We're going to have a little fun tonight, a little celebration with a cast of three guests to celebrate the 20th anniversary of the passing of Measure H. That was the initiative passed by voters in here in the county in March, I think it was March 3rd of 2024. That initiative prohibited the growing of GMOs, or genetically modified organisms, in the county. So we will look at that and also do a little update on GMO technology since then, what's actually happened to GMO technology in the years since Measure H. With us are three guests who worked on the campaign in various capacities. Els Cooperrider was the initiator and sponsor of the campaign with her husband, Alan, who sadly passed away a little over a year ago. She and Alan founded the Ukiah Brewing Company in downtown Ukiah. That was in the early 2000s, I believe. She's with us live, but lives out on Compsie Ukiah Road here in the county. Welcome to Corporations and Democracy, Els.
Hi, Steve. Nice to be here.
And Doug Mosel was the campaign manager for the effort to get Measure H passed by the voters. That was in the 2003 primary election. And I must add, for full disclosure, I myself tried my best to be the right-hand assistant for Doug, as best I could at the time. And that's him laughing in the background. So Doug joins us remotely because he's fighting a bug, but otherwise he still lives here in the county. So welcome to the program, Doug.
Hello, and thank you. Campaign coordinator, to be a little more clear about the role that I played.
And with us is Jonathan Fry. He helped initiate the campaign and was instrumental in handling the lawsuit that was filed against Measure H after it qualified for the election. And I believe was part of the regularly meeting strategy group for the campaign. And again, helped with the lawsuit at that time. Welcome to the program, Jonathan.
Yeah. Thank you, Steve. I'm here for my wife, Katrina, who was the fundraiser for the campaign, but she wasn't able to make it. So I'll see if I can fill in.
And he joins us from Redwood Valley. And we had intention and plans to have with us a guest from the University of California, Berkeley, Assistant Professor Ignacio Chapella. Hey, we have not heard from him today. I'm afraid he got waylaid with something having to do at the university, so we may hear from him later if we're lucky, but we will proceed with our guests as we have. And for starters, for Els, just give us a little background. How the heck did this whole campaign and idea get started back then?
Well, it's what happened is while Alan and I and our kids were running the brew pub, the directors, some of the directors of the Ukiah Natural Foods liked coming over there because we were organic. We were certified organic. Anyway, I got to know three of them pretty well, the late John Milder, Dave Smith, and Johanna Cummings. So the four of us would get together and, you know, have lunch and talk and whatever, complain about the co-op if there was a complaint there. Anyway, that was one of those times that we got together in 2001. And Johanna, John, and Dave Smith, they were complaining about the fact that the management of the co-op refused to label products on their shelves that had GMOs. So that was the discussion at the time. And they were wondering what they could do about it. And after some discussion, I just threw out, kind of in jest, but kind of not maybe, I said, why don't we just outlaw the damn things? Anyway, what happened then is they said, can you actually do that? And I said, well, let's find out. Anyway, we found out. Yes, you can.
So it took a year and a half to come to some level of fruition.
Well, there was an awful lot of work that had to be done before the actual campaign started. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to come up with a lot of paperwork for the county that the county council has to sign off on and so forth. But yes, it took a while.
Well, back then, the biotech industry was somewhat infamous for obfuscating the issue of GMOs and arguably overblowing their benefit, but that's not the first time that any corporation has overblown their product, which is new on the market and not fully tested. Can you tell us a little bit about that issue at the time?
Yeah, that was so disturbing to me, and I didn't realize that that was coming, because I think our initiative here in Mendocino County was the first, I mean, all of you correct me if I'm wrong, was one of the first real tests publicly against genetic engineering and what it is and what it isn't. And so when CropLife America, you know, the biotech industry, Monsanto, DuPont, Syngenta, and Novartis, all of those, got going and got their anti-campaign together. What they did was they're trying to soothe the public by saying, no worries about GMOs. People have been modifying plants and animals for thousands of years. And so what they were basically saying was, GMOs are not that different from a hybrid, or are essentially the same thing. And of course, that's not true, because you know you can't cross a potato with a rat, and we know we can't cross a goat with a spider, and so forth, or a fish and a tomato. But that is basically what they were saying, and so we basically had to educate people.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and a little bit of summary. So genetic, or GMOs and genetic engineering, then, so it involves actually inserting genes from plants or animals that are not involved with a particular animal that you're inserting them into, and what you get is something new, the consequences of which are unknown until you do a whole bunch of testing, I believe. Could you give us a little update on that?
Well, I don't know if I can give you an update on it, but what they do is, because you cannot cross different species, different plants and animals that aren't even related, you can't do that. Everybody knows that. And so they just take the desired gene that controls a certain function like growth and take it out of the chromosome of the animal or plant that has it and stick it into the chromosomes and the DNA of the target organism, like the growth hormone of rats that was then inserted into the growth hormone in rats that was taken out of the rat genome and inserted into the potato so they grow faster, as an example.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And Jonathan, you were involved in that time, and you are from a very organic background, may I say, or what? Tell me a little about your background in the growing business, in the case of the grape growing business and the wine business. But
yeah, we grow grapes in Redwood Valley and Potter Valley, and we've been doing that since the mid '60s, and we started a winery in 1980, so which we are still making wine now. Certainly, it's interesting to follow the agricultural things that are going on. My wife and I studied at the Round Valley Garden Project up in Covelo under the eccentric Englishman Alan Chadwick, who had put together a really great course of study on how to grow just about anything, you know, plants, and there was a little bit of animal stuff involved, but it was a great course and covered all topics from, you know, plant breeding, saving seeds, soil health, of course, making compost. So from that, we got turned on to the subject of healthy soils and food production. And so from that background, would also keep an eye on what was going on in more whatever you'd call mainstream agriculture, and heard about GMOs in the mid-90s when they first became sort of widely used in more large-scale ag. And then there were certainly issues with cross contamination with non-GMOs. I think the basic issue is that people still haven't been able to adequately insert genes. They talk about it, that it's a real precise thing to do, you know, cut and paste and so on. Actually, at that size level, all those genes are sort of like, magnetic jello, let's say, and pretty tough to push around those squiggly things. And if you try to insert genes, unintended changes can ripple through the genes. And so it's still a messy science, in spite of what you might hear. And so the course of it went mostly as a way to get a lock on certain seeds and make them herbicide resistant, which was the main economic motivation at that time and still is to quite a degree to make these kinds of plants. Namely, you can spray them with herbicides, which are very profitable, and they won't be damaged like normal plants would.
Okay, and Doug, you were involved then as the, you clarified it for me, campaign coordinator?
Campaign coordinator.
Uh-huh. And it was after that that I believe that you started the Grain Project, is that right?
Definitely.
Okay, so Doug was running the Mendocino Grain Project for 10, 15 years or so? How long was it?
About a dozen years, yeah.
Okay. All right, and that you started back in, must have been the mid-aughts or what?
Yeah, mid-aughts, 2007, 2008.
Mm-hmm.
But going back to the campaign for a moment, part of the reason I actually ended up farming and growing grain and doing custom hay work is actually the fault of Ailes and Allen. I blame them for it. I was one of those folks who used to hang out at the brew pub, and I got to know Ailes and Allen, and for some strange reason, they had enough confidence in me that they invited me to join the campaign and to coordinate it. That was... It was a turning point, really, in my life in this county, because as a result of that campaign, I became acquainted with people like the Fries and the small scale local farming community, and it was actually through those connections that I ended up becoming a farmer for myself, by myself, and enjoying probably one of the brightest, most enjoyable, most hopeful periods of my 81 years. But the campaign, I want to just say a word about it. I want to piggyback on something Jonathan said, which it's always irked me that this oversimplified approach to modifying nature is done so casually, and in my mind, it actually isn't science, it's technology. And it doesn't rise to the level of honest science. And it is a technology at the university and research level that has been heavily influenced by the very corporations that were mentioned by Ailes. Along with the major seed companies whose intention was and has come to fruition in the ownership of over 90% of the basic seeds that supply the food systems of the world. This oversimplified technology has consequences in living systems that cannot be accounted for in any kind of testing or research, because as Jonathan said, when you insert a micro amount of genetic material, it has its own life and its own way. You don't control that. no matter how you disarm the target organism, you don't disarm that. It has a life of its own, and it'll carry on in its own living processes, integrating that randomly inserted piece of genetic material. But what was to me so exciting and so hopeful about the campaign was that it did what Els said. Its intention was to educate people. And that was the focus of everything that that was at the heart of the campaign. And I actually still have in one of my storage units leftover printed materials and bumper stickers and so on from the campaign. And it was so exciting to see local people, a sheriff holding a large, healthy salmon, commenting on wanting his salmon not to be genetically engineered with a growth hormone that made him grow inordinately large. Signature campaigns, entire newspaper pages of local signatures of people saying, we don't want this stuff. Let's say no to it. A beautifully put together, I forget now the periodic of it, but put together by Sid and company, that was full of information that told the truth and the lies of this manipulative technology. Mm-hmm. That's all.
That was a tip of the hat to Sid Cooperrider, pretty much the creative Absolutely. Artist of the campaign. Who worked many hours, many late hours, when I was there also at campaign headquarters. Those of you that have been to the Akai Brewing Company, the mezzanine was campaign headquarters, and the back office was where the printer was running, where we ran off all the materials for people to pick up in the morning to take elsewhere in the county for distribution to voters and such out at, you know, in front of supermarkets and such. For if you just tuned in recently, in the last few minutes, we are speaking with three of the primary movers for the Measure H campaign, and we're celebrating 20 years since Measure H was passed in March for the primary election in March of 2004. And we're speaking with Els Cooperrider, and that was Doug Mosel a moment ago, and Jonathan Fry. I'm your host, Steve Scalmanini, and he's there in the background. So, there was a lawsuit along the way. It occurred, and shortly after the, I believe, the measure qualified for the ballot, which was probably qualified in November, but I believe the lawsuit came to a head in December. Els, can you tell us a little bit about how that happened and how it went down in the actual, in the courthouse?
Yeah, this was really, we weren't expecting this. We were informed by hand delivery that we were being sued by Plant Health Organization. I think that's what it's called. Doug, you can correct me. And it's basically a front group, an industry group for all of these biotech companies, Monsanto et al. And that came in on Thursday evening at the brew pub. They served this at the brew pub. My name was the first name on that lawsuit, but there was also Janie Shepard, Ron Epstein, those two wonderful people. Janie worked with us. They both worked with us on the whole campaign, but Janie is a lawyer, and she also helped write the measure. And Marsha Wharf, who was at the time the clerk recorder, was also being sued. And the reason for the suit was the biotech industry did not like our ballot statement. And basically, they said it was, the words they love to use, false and misleading. And false and misleading was the stuff that Jonathan mentioned about, you know, you cannot contain these genetically engineered organisms. There's no way to contain them. They can infect the surroundings, so to speak, and hurt biodiversity. So they wanted us to take that statement out of the measure, and the reason Marsha Wharf was also in that lawsuit was because she was the one who was going to print the ballots. And so on Thursday evening, we were served, and the next Wednesday, which was December 24th, that was Christmas Eve, we had our court date. And so we went to court, and this was not a jury trial, obviously. This was something that happened really fast with Judge Lacasse presiding, and Jonathan was one of our expert witnesses, and you did a great job, even though they kept calling you Frey. I remember that.
Right. Done. Right.
Yes. Susan Jordan took it on with as pro bono, and had me sign an agreement that if we won, if she would countersue for attorney's fees, that I would then turn over to her. So that was all settled before we even went to court.
But that is, in fact, what did happen then, right?
Yes. Yeah. Judge Lacasse ruled in our favor, so the biotech industry lost. And it was just a settlement. We didn't have to actually go through the countersuit because they knew it was coming. And so I was sent a check for $20,000, which then went to the attorneys, mm-hmm. both Janie and the late Susan Jordan.
Yes.
And, you know, what was wonderful about that day, it was really crowded in that courtroom. And Katrina, being the fundraiser, got a hat and went around the room and collected $650.
Yeah. Yeah, it was quite an economic battle, too. I believe the Measure H campaign was outspent by about 8-1 compared to the CropLife America industry front group. So that was... it was, you know, a lot of work even raising that amount of money.
Yeah. Actually, the amount of money that Katrina raised, which was, I think, stated by the county as $145,000,
yeah,
was the most anybody ever raised for anything in the county. So right. She broke a record.
Yeah.
And CropLife
spent something like $600,000. Jonathan, it wasn't quite 8-1.
It wasn't quite 8. Okay. Well, it was.
Yeah.
But well outspent.
Gobs of money poured in to their little office off of Perkins Street, which no one ever visited because there was no activity there, because there was virtually no local support for it. There was a vocal but split opposition on the part, for example, of the Farm Bureau board, because there were organic farmers on the board, so they didn't really launch an official campaign against it. All the flashy information, gobs of flashy printed information poured into the county. One of my favorite radio ads that the campaign put together was cleverly had the background sound of coins being poured out of a jar, representing the gobs of money that came pouring in from outside the county to try to defeat our grassroots measure.
You're exactly right, and I have it with me, by the way. I just brought it just in case.
Nice.
Oh,
Sid found
great.
It.
If you could play it, that would be fantastic.
Tape, so yeah, we have it. I have
fun.
It right here.
Maybe Steve can put that in, and we can somehow hear it. But the profound impact of local support was clearly what defeated the opposition. One of the disturbing components of all of that was that after our campaign was successful, and a number of other counties in Northern and Central California attempted their own initiatives, the opposition copied a lot of our campaign strategies, including launching a large parade off of the parking lot, spanking new farm equipment, which was so different from the ragtag parade of our local tractors and floats and pickups in support of our measure. Mm-hmm. That remains amusing to me. But more seriously, one of the local extension agents in Mendocino County, UC California employee, wrote a paper talking about our campaign and the components and elements and tactics of it, which was then used to inform the opposition campaigns in other counties.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the action items in the campaign, I know, was coming out very early and contacting the public at a lot of stores, in front of a lot of stores. And
we had some help from Percy Schmeiser, too, who was a well-known farmer from Canada whose business was heavily damaged by cross-contamination with GMOs.
Indeed. He visited us twice, actually, and was a participant in a couple of forums and was very well received as a kind of folk hero of the anti-GMO movement.
Yes, and he also
hang on a second.
He also made a radio ad for us.
I forgot that.
Yeah, Sid found them all, and he gave them to me this morning. Anyway, the waterfall ad is here.
Okay, so I will...
Let's hear the waterfall ad.
I will play this. It's going to come through a microphone, so...
That's all right.
We'll see how it sounds that way. I can't run it through a cord. So stand by here and
listen. That's the sound of Monsanto, DuPont, Dow Chemical, and others spending thousands of dollars on a smear campaign to defeat Measure H. These are the same corporations that brought us DDT, dioxin, and Agent Orange. Now, hiding behind the name Crop Life America, they are trying to force us to use genetically altered crops which will contaminate our native varieties. Genetically altered foods and crops have been banned by most of Europe and rejected by the largest fast food companies in America. It's no wonder Crop Life has hired the same public relations firm that the tobacco industry uses. Measure H is homegrown and endorsed by thousands of Mendocino County residents who understand the importance of protecting our jobs, our environment, and our way of life. And no amount of money can change that. Join us in protecting Mendocino. Vote yes on Measure H, paid for by the Committee for a GMO-Free Mendocino.
Yes,
well, we couldn't hear the waterfall, but we got the gist of the message. That was a good one.
There's a few others there, too. I don't know if I'll have time for them. To listeners, we're speaking with three of the primary movers in the campaign for Measure H. That's 20 years ago, so we're celebrating a little bit that it's been 20 years since March of 2004 when Measure H was passed and the county outlawed the growing of genetically modified organisms, GMOs, in the county. We will be taking calls for the latter half of the show here, so if you'd like to make a comment or ask a question, we are at 895-2448. So once again, 895-2448 is the number to join the conversation here. Now, there was, can you talk a little bit about the threat to biodiversity of the whole GMO industry?
Well, you know, that was Alan was a PhD conservation biologist, and biodiversity was his thing. So he, for instance, redwoods are genetically engineered, and they will their seed will contaminate other redwoods that are natural. I mean, this is how it happens in nature, and it's already happening. And I'm sure both Doug and Jonathan will have more examples of that.
That's the first I heard about redwoods.
Oh, so yes.
GMO tree. I know about GMO trees. I hadn't read redwoods in articles about
there
GMO trees.
There were GMO redwoods already when we started our initiative that were being grown in Humboldt County.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just like to add that one of the good things about starting the GMO measure in Mendocino County at the time was that nobody was already growing or profiting from GMO crops. So, in other words, it was brand new. People hadn't done it, so it wasn't going to put anybody out of business.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we had already established, I believe, in the county at that time, the precautionary principle. And I believe it was on the coast. One of the coastal communities did that. Escapes me which community, but it was
Point Arena, I think.
Point Arena? Britt Bailey. That name rings a bell. Some of you might remember that. By the way, I wanted to tie up a couple loose ends from earlier, talking about the brew pub. The brew pub, the Yukai Brewing Company, was the first of its kind, the first organic brewery and restaurant in the country, I believe.
That's true.
Okay. So there, and I think there was another maybe brewery somewhere that was organic, but this was food.
Yeah,
first
brew pub. And I would just like to add that Fry Vineyards was the very first certified organic winery in the United States as well, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
So we're two firsts.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
And you're here on our show and taking calls if anybody wishes. 895-2448. Okay, wanted to make sure the phones were transferred over here to the studio in Talmadge. So, anyone have an update on the organic market that's been happening over the last few decades? I have not heard any latest news on it. So, the market for organic food and organic restaurants, for that matter, any idea how that is doing?
It's doing quite well. It's becoming much more accepted. As shown by the growth in market share, with the recent spate of higher prices, it slowed just a little, but it's still growing steadily as people start to understand the benefits of healthy soils and more nutrient-dense foods and the other attributes of organically grown food. So it's grown into quite a large sector.
We have our first caller. Can you hang on a moment there? Caller, you're live on the air. What's your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, this is Katrina Fry calling in. And I'm sorry I'm not there. Jonathan's doing a great job, of course. But and I'm sorry, I turned off my radio, so I'm not sure what you're talking about for the last 2 minutes. But I did want to say that as far as fundraising went, it became evident that we were maybe going to have to reach outside of the county as well. And because of many years of attending natural products shows and conferences, I was friends with some of the larger members. And Nell Newman, Paul Newman's daughter, started off the wave by giving us $10,000. And then a couple of very influential nonprofits, the Organic Farming and Research Center, which is still based in Santa Cruz, helped fund us, as well as the Organic Consumers Association. So we did reach out into the larger organic community, and we're supported there. And at some point, I think it'd be important for Jonathan to just give some references about the very effective groups that are still educating and working to prevent the proliferation. So that's all, but it sounds fun. Brings back those days on the mezzanine.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Hey. Jonathan.
Yeah, you talked about the groups that are working in this field now. I guess one I could highly recommend that was still around, I mean, that's still around now and was around then. They're called gmwatch.org, run by a person, Claire Robinson and Jonathan Matthews. So they still have an excellent, pretty near every few days, updates on what's happening in the wider GMO, you know, industry legally and, you know, otherwise. So that's really an eye-opener. It's great to check out what they're doing. Other aspects of modifying organisms using gene splicing and whatnot have grown also, maybe not in a good way, especially with microbes and viruses. So that's a real big issue nowadays. It's sort of off a lot of people's radar, but it has to do with modifying viruses to make weapons. This whole issue of bio, you know, weaponry is a real sleeper nowadays. And the laboratories working on this are funded quite well and are growing rapidly all around the world. But it's a concern to a lot of people. You know, especially with all the lab leaks, which includes the COVID virus, of course, now, you know, very well established that hopped out of a lab. So you'll probably be hearing quite a bit more about that in the coming years as people try to get a handle on these kinds of weapons-based, you know, approaches to using this kinds of technology.
Not to mention that the technology, thank you for using technology there, Jonathan. Not to mention the most common COVID viruses were genetically modified, genetically engineered.
Correct.
And from my standpoint, as a now retired grain farmer, one of the current stories that I'm following is this nifty new genetically modified wheat. That is actually being grown and milled in Argentina. It's called by the lovely name HB4, and it is engineered to tolerate glufosinate ammonium, and it is being blended. The flour is being blended with other flours and distributed to people without any kind of information or labeling. The approval of this experimental wheat, which is now being opposed by researchers, not just because of its environmental and health impact, but because it turns out the dang thing doesn't produce well either. It was approved by a commission in Argentina that consisted entirely of big ag representatives. So this represents why I have to tell you all and your listeners that I have grown discouraged and cynical, honestly, because this technology has so taken over and has so now, I will say, infested our agricultural, our health systems. It's essentially a runaway now. One of my sons asked me recently if I knew whether or not rennet in cheese is genetically engineered. And I had to confirm just when this occurred. But it was in 1996 that genetically modified rennet in cheese was approved for use without labeling, without any information to consumers. And this now is the case with all but organic or honest animal rennet cheeses. and another example of how people are consuming it without their knowledge. While I was still doing my radio show, I reported every year or so, I reported on a study being conducted in the UK whereby they would examine flour-based food products from cookies to bread. And over the years, they could track the increasing presence of glyphosate and pesticides in these flour products. So it is now pervasive. And the best option for consumers, for eaters, is to eat as simply and locally as they possibly can, because they do not know. And the labeling has become increasingly compromised so that we don't even know for sure whether it is being allowed in the processing of even organically labeled foods, because there are multiple, I'm forgetting the right word now to use, there are multiple substances that are used in the processing of foods, increasingly the highly processed foods, that don't even have to be identified on ingredient labels. So people don't know how the food they're consuming is being contaminated or tainted or modified by these processing ingredients. I'll stop. Okay. That was too long. Sorry.
Well, someone did call in during that time. Caller, you're live on the air. I think they might have hung up because I had them potted way down low. So, caller, sorry, but do call back. I will pick you up. You might be on hold for just some seconds, but give a call back. And here they are, perhaps. Hello, caller. You're live on the air.
Hi, Raimundo here. Just curious about the COVID-19 vaccine as to whether or not that was genetically modified. And if so, what does that mean for the people who were injected with it? Thank you.
Okay, that was about the vaccine then?
Yeah, that was also, I guess you'd call it a GMO product. It doesn't, it modifies subgenes, the mRNA, the microRNA, and it could be, accurately could be called a genetic vax. Yeah, because it's a gene modified therapy. It's meant to modify your genes or the recipient of it to create certain proteins that your body will then mount antibodies. So yeah, it's a gene therapy.
Okay, and my understanding is that there's plenty of evidence that COVID itself, as you mentioned earlier briefly, is an escaped virus.
Yeah, just in the last several months, that's been quite well established that it did, that it was a lab escape. Several pretty intrepid, investigative reporters have tracked it down with a lot of sleuthing. And U.S. Right to Know, it's USRTK.org, has kind of the blow-by-blow account of how all that went down. And so it's coming to the fore much more than previously.
So let me mention that a couple of addresses. One of them, once again, that you just heard, USRTKRightToKnow.org. And that's where you can get some of the information about the most recent information about the origins of COVID-19. And mentioned earlier was GMWatch.org. And that's where the work of and research work of Jonathan Matthews and Claire Robinson is about the more recent developments of GMO technology regarding food and agriculture. Let's talk about the state preemption law that came up after the Measure H was passed. So that was 20 years ago, March of 2004. And then the state reacted at some point after that. Can one of you give us some background on that? Okay, well, the last I heard, and I forget how long it took. It wasn't, you know, within a year or two afterwards.
Yeah, there was a law passed which wouldn't allow other counties to further pass these kinds of laws. And I think it's kind of nationwide right now. Mm-hmm. And you see that in other aspects of farming, like Iowa, they keep trying to push a bill through where the pesticide manufacturers can't be sued, and you know, as well as shutting down any kinds of initiatives that would ban things which are legal at the federal level. But unfortunately, the agencies, you know, FDA and USDA and so on, are pretty well captured, as they say, nowadays.
Let's take this next call. Caller, you're live on the air. What's your first name and from where are you calling?
My name is Sid Anga. I'm from somewhere between Ukiah and Comfrey.
Okay.
Yes, I'm Sid. I'm related to...
Oh, it's Sid. Okay, I did not hear that clearly at first. Right. I know that name. Somewhere out on Comfrey Ukiah Road.
I wanted some of you to respond about how fun was it the night we won?
Well, I certainly remember it.
It was very fun, and I remember, I'll never forget, what was his name? Tony Craver up on the stage there. But the best part for me was the fight with the AP reporter that you had, Jonathan.
The what?
You don't remember fighting with the AP reporter?
Oh, sure. Yeah, that was interesting.
This is a fun little story. You know, we got to write down one of these days.
Yeah. Yeah. There were people blowing horns out in the street, and yeah, it was a real whoop-de-doo.
Ram's horns, as I recall.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yep.
You're a little bit fuzzy on the line. If you can just sit still or in a one spot that might get good reception, we could hear you a little clearer.
The pub was literally wall-to-wall with people that night. I mean, it was like a rock concert or something equivalent to that, where in order to move through the place, you imagine that you'd be in contact with multiple other bodies in order to make your way from one spot to another.
Well, I can comment on that because a slight bit of comedy in the evening was when it was finally time for Els to speak on the little elevated stage there where sometimes musicians would play. And she had her papers in front of her, but she was missing one thing, her eyeglasses.
Oh, dear.
And I was up in the mezzanine and was able to find them somehow, but I'm the one that had to wade through the crowd. Actually, I waited just to the side door and then went outside around to the main door to make it faster to reach her on that little stage.
Yeah,
and then she had her set her.
I remember Alan and Brett and Sid saying, "There's no point in serving anything but beer and wine, because there was no way any waitress could get through the crowd." Yeah,
and it was quite the front page story, with a very large photo of that crowd the next day or two later or whatever. But you know, shortly after,
I think it was the following morning. Yeah, I think it might have been. Yes, even though the editor of that paper was not in favor of what was happening with that measure, mm-hmm. but nevertheless, it made the paper.
Yeah, and how?
Yeah,
and yes, quite.
Not just the paper, but literally, it made the new. It actually made worldwide news.
Yes,
it did.
Shockwaves through.
We had
through the whole establishment.
Mm-hmm. We had reporters at the brew pub from Russia, Japan, Korea, Australia, Argentina. I mean, just about everywhere, and not to mention most of the major newspapers in the U.S. NPR did a story on it, and it was big news. And I think that the fact that we got sued by the biotech industry called an awful lot of attention to it, and that, in my view, it also, if anybody in the county still didn't know about it, about Measure H and what was going on, I think the little people like us getting sued by these multinational giant corporations just was over the top. And I think it got a lot of attention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and outspent by about 5 or 6 to 1 on the campaign. I wanted to type another loose end from a few minutes ago. The I think it was the news media from out of the area and out of the state, for that matter, you know, was present, and they were all greeted with press kits with a full of artwork by Sid on the phone with us right now, and a tip of the hat to Laura Hamburg for helping put those together.
Yes, I'm glad you mentioned Laura.
Another one of those evening projects that occurred when we could focus on material items like that to get ready for the next day of people taking materials to do campaigning. So quite an episode.
If I'm still there.
Okay, yes. We can hear you now.
I'd like to say yes.
Yes, yes, right.
Yes.
On H. Yes. Became yes.
Yes.
Well, I think it was right at the very beginning of the campaign. I think most people know that when you put an initiative on the ballot, the only way it's going to pass is if people vote yes on that initiative. They have to vote yes, no matter what it is. If you want something like this to pass, it has to have a vote of yes. So we early on in the campaign, and Sid was really good with this work too, we didn't want people to say no to GMOs. That was just not going to work, because people might then go to the ballot and say no on this measure. And it was a really big deal. I know it sounds like a little detail, but it's not. It's really hard to say very, very positive, so that the name became GMO-free Mendocino, which is positive. It was never no to GMOs. I don't think any of our literature ever had that in there. And that was
it's called framing.
Yes.
Which is what the industry does so darn well.
Exactly.
And so the average less informed person takes their glossy, promising, greenwashed descriptions of their technology and its great benefits without understanding just exactly what's going on, because they frame it so cleverly.
Exactly.
And indeed, we framed this cleverly.
Yes.
Which took plenty of thinking. I remember when that struggle was occurring about.
Well, there was quite a bit of struggle, I remember, and Doug, I'm sure you do. The people wanted us to answer the biotech industry with their assaults on our campaign. And we didn't do it. But it was really, really hard for some people. The very fact that we refused to allow the biotech industry to frame the issue. So we put out press releases, or Laura Hamburg did, and we refused to answer their assaults, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
You know, closing the library and all of that kind of stuff that they said would happen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
One other.
And give a shout out to Joe Wildman, too.
Yeah, Joe Wildman did a great job.
The late Joe.
Bless his memory there. One other loose end, regarding the state law. Now, as I recall, when the state preemption occurred, it occurred that any county that wanted to go GMO-free, like we did here, would have to be granted that also by the Ag Commissioner for the state. And I'm not aware of any county that has tried to do it since. But we did not get preempted, so we have remained with, you know, GMO-free Measure H has stood. But any other county would have to get approval, and I don't recall if it's approval before or after passing such an initiative. So that's a loose end, which will just remain for the time being. And one other item I wanted to mention before we're done, which will be just in a minute and a half, and that is that there was a threat a few years ago of a company that wanted to bring in GMO cannabis to the county. And that they had their eyes on growing in Covelo. And so Annie did a quick call to Jen Percacci, who is one of the hosts of the Cannabis Hour every few weeks on Thursday afternoons. And the news was that it just didn't materialize, possibly because of the drop in cannabis costs or prices when it went legal. So just for what it's worth, that threat did not occur, and we have remained GMO-free without some kind of confrontation over that particular crop. And so thank you for being with us, our three guests. Els Cooperreiter, thanks for being on our show.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Doug.
And
thank you.
Doug, okay, and to Jonathan.
Thank you, Steve.
Okay, this has been a birthday party for Measure H, or Yesh, as it was. And fortunately, with some knowledge, I can still follow my strategy for quality eating. I call it, give me that old-time nutrition.
Yeah.
Amen.
Okay. Thanks, everybody. This has been Corporations and Democracy.